Building Bridges, Not Walls, with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Are the chickens coming home to roost again? Well, it's a new day of infamy, but it's rooted in centuries-old white supremacy.
The far-right siege on the U.S. Capitol has been called unbelievable, shocking, and beyond imagination. But let's not forget the attacks on state houses around the nation and all the symbols hate deployed. Guillotine, hangman's noose, Confederate and Nazi iconography, though they received far less coverage.
The playbook for the MAGA invasion of the nation's Capitol building has been developing for years in plain sight. At far-right rallies, in cities like Charlottesville, Berkeley, and Portland, and then in the past year at state capitals across the country, where heavily armed white protesters have forced their way into legislative chambers to accuse politicians of tyranny and treason. While what happened was outrageous and wrong, was it really unbelievable?
The far right's fears about replacement of the white race and outsider invasions, and its anger is routinely stoked by the President of the United States and his cronies. White nationalism is closer to the mainstream of American politics than ever before.
This is a dangerous and scary time, but it's not the first, and it won't be the last eruption of the white supremacist violence we experience. Let's not get fooled thinking the 25th Amendment, impeachment, prosecutions of insurrectionists and or those in power who incited violence, sedition, will end this. Historians are rightly making connections to the Civil War, including declaring the Confederacy finally stormed the Capitol. But white supremacy goes deeper than the Civil War and predates slavery. It is foundational to the U.S. settler state.
So, instead of being shocked, this time, let's learn our history and let's start showing up for racial justice, against poverty and for economic justice, as internationalists and against militarism, and live that credo and standing firmly against redbaiting.
We're joined now by Eric Ward, Executive Director and Senior Fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Race Forward.
Eric Ward is Executive Director of Western State Center, a national hub for innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. Ward is a nationally recognized expert on the relationship between authoritarian movements, hate violence, and building toward inclusive democracy.
Eric, I'm torn between saying, how do you describe what happened on January 6th and going further back, which is, who were the party that stimulated the events of January 6th? Help us understand who was involved and what you think actually happened with a kind of unity of purpose, apparently, on January 6th.
I think it's important for all of us to understand is that what we are witnessing, not just on January 6th in D.C., but what we are witnessing since then is an insurrection. We're not talking about an attempt to overthrow a policy or to force the resignation of an elected official. What we are talking about is an attempt to put into place an authoritarian leader. And we have to understand that that is what is occurring. Now, on Wednesday, January 6th in Washington, D.C., what the American public witnessed was a configuration of a number of entities, everything from groups like the Three Percenters, Proud Boys, white nationalists, anti-vaxxer, anti-mask movements. It was a configuration of the far right that has largely been centered around a coalition that we in America understand as the alt-right. The alt-right has its roots within the white nationalist movement in this country. The white nationalist movement is a social movement. Similarly to how environmental movements function or the civil rights movement, it is a social movement that does not seek to preserve white supremacy. In fact, it sees white supremacy, a historical system of discrimination, as a failed program. It seeks instead to overthrow the U.S. government in order to establish a government that can proceed in creating an all-white ethnostate, meaning a nation state that is free of Jews and people of color. If white supremacy is about exploitation, white nationalism is about ethnic cleansing, and it understands that it needs to control society in order to see that through. What we saw on January 6th was an attempt by a diverse array of organizations and leaders in an attempt to pursue their goals. But what aligned them was the belief that in order to pursue their individual goals, they first needed to take control of government. And that is what we witnessed on Wednesday, January 6th. We can go into a little bit of details about some of the different goals of what I believe may have been some of the different goals of different tendencies within that coalition. But all of us should understand that the absolute goal was the banding together of far-right elements to overthrow the U.S. government. And they were very serious in their intent.
Please do parse out some of the fundamental players and within that coalition or unity of purpose, at least for January 6th, although they seem to have cohered before that and pronounced loudly and aggressively over social media that they had every intention of figuratively, if not literally, storming the gates of government. So help us understand who these groups are, and then if additional clarification. I had thought and would suggest that the unifying factor was indeed white supremacy, the form of control which evolves from plantation capitalism of the populace, of people of color across the board, most definitively in response to the preeminent cry, which was heard around the world, of Black Lives Matter, also the manifestations of xenophobia, et cetera, that are part of the conceptualization of white supremacy. So I know that's a lot to put on your plate, but take the ball.
Oh, it is a moment that calls for the willingness of those of us who believe in equity, who believe in human rights, who believe in the idea that everyone has the right to live, love, worship, work free from fear and bigotry, to dive into these complexities and to understand them. So I think it's a great question. Is what we have to understand is that white supremacy, a historic and present-day system of exploitation that was grounded upon three pillars. The first was the genocide of Native people and the theft of their lands and resources. The second pillar was the exploited labor of Black people through over 500 years of chattel slavery. The third is the control of women and sexuality. Those were the three grounding pillars that allowed white supremacy to become the socializing force of our society. It was the rule of law. And I say was because in the 1960s, a movement arose on the American terrain known as the 1960 Civil Rights Movement that contested white supremacy as the rule of law. And I would argue, actually defeated white supremacy. Now, I'm not saying white supremacy still doesn't exist, and I'm not saying that it doesn't impact our lives. Certainly as an African American, I'm very clear about how white supremacy impacts my life each and every day. What I'm saying is that white supremacy moved from being uncontested to being placed on contested terrain. And ever since, social movements in the United States grounded around equality and opportunity have continued to chip away significantly at the vestiges and the impact of white supremacy. How do we know this? Because these largely led black social movements have ensured that the life I live in 2021 may be difficult, may be filled with anti-blackness, but it is not what my parents experienced in 1920s, and it is not what their great-grandparents experienced in 1820. So we have to understand that social movements that are driven by black community have contested white supremacy in very successful ways. Now, we have this 1960s civil rights movement, and it's actually successful at contesting white supremacy. Now, imagine for a second you're an arch segregationist. You believe in Jim Crow. You believe, as you have been socialized for generations, that black people and other people of color, women, religious minorities such as Jews and Muslims are inferior simply based off of their belief systems, their perhaps biological makeup, right, or the color of their skin. How do you all of a sudden come to terms with the fact that you've lost to people you see as inferior in every way? It's simply impossible. In 1968, arch segregationists simply weren't going to wake up and say, well, I guess I'm wrong. Black people must not be inferior after all. They needed to come up with an answer. And it is in that answer that white nationalism takes shape in the United States. What happens is if white supremacy is written upon the paper of race in America, white nationalism became written on the paper of anti-Semitism. What I mean by this, the inability of these segregationists, these white supremacists, to believe that black people had agency and could build collective power to bring America into a real democracy, meant that they had to find someone else to blame. And borrowing from anti-Semitic tracts like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, a fake anti-Semitic narrative that was rampant in Europe, they constructed a new narrative that they didn't lose to black people, that they lost to a global Jewish conspiracy that sought to destroy the white race. It is that first conspiracy theory that distinguishes white nationalism from the system of white supremacy. Those of us who care about real democracy, inclusive democracy, people-centered, transparent, and accountable government have to contend with the fact that we are dealing both with a system of disparity called white supremacy and a social movement called white nationalism. And white nationalism is not committed to the program of white supremacy. It is not seeking to exploit people of color, but to remove them altogether. And one way that that has shown up has been within the immigration debates in this country. If we have noticed, as this white nationalist social movement continues to gain power and emerge into the mainstream, conversation on immigration has evolved from debates around how much we are willing to exploit immigrants, right, to how much we are willing to criminalize immigrants in this country. That is white supremacy transitioning into white nationalism to a place where today many of us can still sleep comfortably at night despite the fact that immigrant children are being held in cages within our country. That is the power of white nationalism, and it is distinguished from white supremacy. But we conflate white nationalism and white supremacy each and every day. You cannot conflate them because the tools and the tactics required to respond to each phenomenon are different. And if we try to conflate them, we undercut our own ability to address both of these phenomena.
I continue to think in my own mind about Wilhelm Reich's The Mass Psychology of Fascism. The issue of what drives white people overarchingly to these extremist philosophies, whether it's to the militia-type organizations or whether it's the Boogaloo Boys or the Proud Boys or the QAnon theories, which are reminiscent of things like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which you referenced. It would still seem to me that the mechanism for this mass psychology of fascism taking root is indeed white supremacy, and I think back on the brilliance of W.E.B. Du Bois when he was talking about how, in what would seem to be antithetical to their interests, white people still long to be overseers. What makes this vicious, murderous philosophy of destroying the other take hold in the populace? And so, again, the glue there seemed to be that conceptualization of white supremacy, that people can advance on that, because certainly nothing is being offered to these people materially that would cause them to adhere to this philosophy, to digest it, even though they may have some perception they're losing some element of their privilege. So maybe you can flesh that out for us a bit more.
It's important, I think, to realize that this is not a phenomena that appeared last Wednesday in January 6th in Washington, D.C. Certainly, white nationalism has its origins in white supremacy. But I think we do ourselves a mistake. We become the conservative force, right? We as progressives or those on the left, liberals, we become the conservatizing force if we refuse to recognize that other social movements, other ideologies also evolve and shape. When we talk about the American racial justice movement or the American left today, we are not talking about the same movement that existed in the 1920s or in the 1890s, right? To use an example, neither should we treat social movements or systemic phenomena that we may oppose as static items. I think one of the ways that I try to think about this is in this way, that these are not extremist movements. We need to drop the term extremist, but these are movements that I believe are tendencies that exist in American society that are tapped into in order to build political power. What is an example of that? I'll think back to September 11th and the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the third plane that went down in Pennsylvania. Immediately after those attacks, I was living at the time in Seattle, Washington, working for a human rights group. When I learned about the attack, by the time I got to my office, I had already received two reports. The first is a banner that was hung over a freeway in Seattle that said, "Death to the Palestinians." The second report that I received was that someone had shoved a stick of dynamite under the gas line of a Jewish house of worship in the sister city of Tacoma, Washington, and had written, "Death to the Zionist," I believe, something like that. These were the first two reported responses to 9/11. Well, we know over the subsequent days, there were dozens, if not hundreds, of hate crimes targeting people who were perceived to be Muslim, Arab, and South Asian, including Latinos, including Sikhs. Over that weekend, at least two Sikh Americans, but I believe three Sikh Americans, had been murdered. Now, we have to ask the question, as we saw these hate crimes rise, was it the attacks of September 11th that unleashed this anti-Muslim hate spree and other forms of hate crimes? Or was it that the American public simply felt that it now had permission to act out on the bigotry that it already held? Well, I think there's an answer to that. As we watched these hate crimes continue to grow around the country and in our region, there was a point where it nearly just dropped off. It just suddenly stopped. And that moment seemed to correlate around when, at the time, President Bush and John Ashcroft, who was the attorney general, took to the airwaves and said, hate crimes will not be tolerated against Muslims in the United States. As soon as that was said publicly, there was significant decline in the number of hate acts being reported. In the same way, I share that story because what I believe in this moment isn't that white supremacy is dying or white nationalism is somehow on the rise. What I believe in this moment is that the events that occurred in D.C. were not simply because of the actions of the white nationalist movement and the larger alt-right coalition that it's formed. The events were allowed to take place because for 4 years, for 10 years, for 30 years, elected officials, our democratic institutions, and our human rights and progressive social movements in this country have failed to take the white nationalist movement seriously. We refuse in our own arrogance to concede that social movements are not all built on inclusion and that our social movements are not the only one who can have influence in our society. The failure last Wednesday, January 6th, was not just the federal government, but our own social movement and our own commitment to real leadership and governance in this country.
Could you go back and parse out for us who some of the leadership groups are? Who are they? They need to be named. And also within that is their relevance, influence in government itself. At this point, they are being fed and funded and nurtured by certainly considerable elements within the Republican Party. Who are these groups? Sure, who helped them reach some level of unity from what were disparate and antagonistic tendencies? And then who is encouraging, utilizing their philosophy to generate political power for themselves?
Where I would take us back to understand that story, and I know I keep using long historical arcs, but I'm using them because I think it's really important. We saw taking place in Washington, D.C., actually begins in August of 1992. And some folks would take it back even further. But in 1992, there is an individual by the name of Randy Weaver. He lives in northern Idaho. He was scheduled to go on trial for selling sawed-off shotguns to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He sold it to an informant. He defied the U.S. government's attempts to arrest him. And held up in a cabin where he stockpiled with weapons and food. Law enforcement, after a shooting where one of the marshals was wounded, it ended up with Randy Weaver's wife and son, young son, being killed in the subsequent firefight and siege. This was shocking to the far right. Now, for many Black Americans and Latinos and Native Americans, having draconian law enforcement, use brutal violence, and refuse to de-escalate wasn't new. But for the white supremacist, white nationalist, right, this was something new to them. Many of them were outraged by the botched surveillance operation, and it created a true cross-section of rage. Many of these individuals, led by hardcore white nationalists, such as Pete Peters and Red Beckman, who was a Christian identity minister, he believed that Jews were the literal children of Satan, people of color were subhuman, organized an event at Estes Parks, Colorado in 1992. This was one of the first true gatherings of a cross-section of the American far right, and it occurred in the Rocky Mountains. It led to the creation of the militia movement in this country, a fusion of gun rights advocates, Second Amendment advocates, the religious right, and white nationalists into a coalition to overthrow the U.S. government. As one speaker said in the meeting at Estes Parks, we need to build, he said, a broad coalition, right, that could even include progressives. It said we needed, in his own words, to build a broad-based coalition that was perhaps even multicultural. That at the end of the day, the speaker went on, and I paraphrase, first we take on the federal government, then we take on the question of the Jews. This was in 1992. Here in 2021, we saw the culmination of that organizing, because it had not been disrupted, not by government, not by community leaders, not by social movement. And the movement that met in 1992 has formed and morphed and evolved ever since. So what we saw on the streets of D.C. as part of this insurrection was a large array of organizations and ideologies that have joined under the banner of Trumpism.
Eric Ward, executive director and senior fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Race Forward, and executive director of Western State Center, a national hub of innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. Thank you for joining us.
This has been part one of a two-part program. Tune into Building Bridges next week for part two.
To all our listeners, stay strong, stay well, educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for a better world. Is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.